it is really my pleasure to introduce this guy who's, I think, going to provide us with some great information. And I want you to all know that I've practiced all day being able to say anthropomorphic. Let me draw a line through. So it's really human-caused changes in the Mississippi River Delta. And Richie Blank is going to share with us his vast amount of knowledge and experience in that part of the world and what's going on there. And then he's also told me that the next session will be what they're doing about fixing this damage. So stay tuned for that one. But today's session is being recorded. And please know that as you participate in any conversations that take place, you will also be recorded. Glad you're all here.
Thanks. Thanks so much. So the Mississippi River, So the Mississippi River drains about 40% of the continental United States. It drains something like 23 states and part of two Canadian provinces. So the Delta was formed over the last 7,000 years, shortly after the last ice age. And over the years, it's swapped back and forth across coastal Louisiana, creating many wetlands. And you can see down here at the bottom, my very crude stick. This is near my home here. This is some of the newest land in the country. It's only about 500 years old or so. And it's a delta, so it's naturally sinking. So it's one of the natural causes of the subsidence. In the 1930s, the humans, we started building protection levees along the Mississippi River, and all of these distributaries here that look similar to veins, most of those were blocked off. It was just the easiest thing to do at the time, but folks weren't thinking very far into the future. So that prevented a lot of sediment from working its way out into the wetlands. At the time that this chart was made, the river was only about 20 feet deep or so here, and now it's about 95. The river was spread out over thousands of square acres of wetlands, and the channeling of that river was done to allow for ships to navigate upriver to New Orleans, and also to protect homes from flooding. So this is a map of the current land area in Louisiana, but it doesn't look very similar to the maps that you think of when you see Louisiana. You think it looks like a boot. And those maps were made in the 1930s, and everything above these barrier islands was almost solid land. So when you take away the wetlands from Louisiana, it looks like this. So the wetlands are very, very important there for many reasons. Ecologically, it's just incalculable how much value they have. For hurricane protection purposes, the city of New Orleans is valued at hundreds of billions of dollars. It would be vastly disruptive if that city were if it had to be displaced. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the causes of the land loss. So we have subsidence, the delta is naturally sinking, and then sea level rise, which we're really yet to see beyond just a few millimeters in Louisiana. So there are also 20,000 miles of pipeline canals dug in Louisiana for oil and gas exploration and also navigation. There's natural erosion that's occurring, and hurricanes, of course. And there was some logging in the 1930s, and the river levees are a huge cause as well. So this chart shows, this is 50-year projections for sea level rise. Everything in red is going to be lost. The green is what's going to be added. You can see there's very little, and this is without human intervention. So we'll go ahead and dive into some of these causes here. So the levees. If some of you are from Seattle, I imagine. And if you were looking at a ship in, somewhere in Seattle, you'd probably be looking down at it and not up at the ship. And you could really get a sense of just how low-lying this area is if you look at the bottom of the levee near where the fence is and look up at that ship. It really prevents the sediment from working its way out into the wetlands, and we found ourselves at this point where the communities are now, where they once were 1 or 2 feet above sea level, now they're in a bowl. So you can see the wasted sediment down here near the mouth of the river. What's happening down here, sediment is being jettisoned off the continental shelf, and it's bypassing all of these wetlands that are starved for sediment in this area. So this shows some logging activity in Louisiana. And what was done, there were just hundreds and hundreds of miles of canals, and this was a log pole. It was very similar technology. What was used around here, where folks would put a pulley up on a pole and bring the trees down the mountain, and very similar to getting them out of the swamp, they would just put a pulley on top of a cypress log, and they would just drag these trees through the marsh. And when you fly over, it looks like wagon wheels all over the place. And what that did, it got rid of a really robust wetland buffer that protected the city and the folks that lived there. So the canals act as sort of a highway for salt water. Louisiana had thousands of miles of bayous and just these meandering tidal creeks. There were so many that many didn't even have names, and many small bays and bayous that the salt water would take many days to work its way in for a hurricane. It just didn't happen overnight. And these things, it's just an interstate for saltwater. So what would happen is saltwater would work its way in, and it would kill cypress forests and other freshwater wetlands. So the oil and gas extraction itself it caused subsidence. And it's, if you think about drinking a glass of iced tea, if there's ice in the glass, you drink the tea, the ice is gonna slide down to the bottom. Well, when you extract oil and gas and the water that comes along with it, what happens is there's a void in the ground, and it causes the land itself to sink. And you can see the black line with the black squares is the land loss. And I mean, it's directly tied to the oil and gas activity. And of course, there's the hurricanes, which may or may not be a human-induced cause, depending on your intensity and what you believe about climate change. But to illustrate a little bit about the oil and gas activity that happened in the Delta, if you pay attention to the top right-hand corner, you can see the little harbor of Myrtle Grove. And this area is called the Texaco Canals. And there were many, many canals dug here for oil and gas exploration. It was a very productive oil field, and it was necessary for national defense during the Second World War. So this next slide is from 2010, and you can see just how much land has been lost. In the upper right-hand corner, you can see the Harbor of Myrtle Grove there to get an idea of just how much land has been lost and how this place has been cut up like Swiss cheese.
So the dark on that one is all water?
That's all water, exactly, yes. So this is really dialed down to one local area, but when you zoom out to the state level, you can see just how much oil and gas activities happened in the coastal zone of Louisiana. So there's also other causes of land loss. These are the Empire jetties, and this was a navigation canal, and this jetty was put here so vessels could get in and out of the beach line without running around on a sandbar. And what was happening, sediment was working its way from the right-hand side of the photo, which would have been the Delta side, over towards the left, headed east to west. This next picture is from 2010. This one's from 1949. And so you get an idea. It prevented the sand from working its way around the jetties, and now the beach is a half mile back. So all these causes compound to create. So this chart was from about the 1970s, and this next one was from about 2010 or 2012. and you can see we're, what's happening is we're NOAA is literally taking places off of the map. These areas are no longer in existence according to NOAA, and it's not just these, you know, funny name places on this chart. It's real places like Cat Island. In 1998, this island was 40 acres in size, and in 2004 it looked like this. And so this is this was a rookery before. There were pelicans that were nesting here and other shorebirds, and now the island is completely gone. And it's not just you know, the natural environment that's being affected too. It's people. This is my buddy Pete Lunievich, and the picture that he's holding is his grandfather's oyster camp. And you can see in the picture he's holding, there's a vast amount of marsh in the background. And if you look in the background of this one, there's just not too much. That shell pile wouldn't be there if the people wouldn't have put it there. So, and this is all before sea level rise has really kicked off in earnest. The red is just 1 foot of sea level rise. And you can see just how low-lying coastal Louisiana is. The highest elevation in the entire state is only 535 feet, and it's in the northern part of the state. The 1 meter of sea level rise is reaching almost all the way to Baton Rouge. And if you put a hurricane on top of this, the results are quite devastating. So the next slide shows subsidence rates, sea level rise rates all around the country. And these blue marks up here in the Pacific Northwest are actually the glaciers up here over the last ice age melted, and so the rocks are actually able to rise a bit now that weight has lifted off of them. But all around the rest of the country, there's been just a few millimeters of sea level rise. It hasn't been too many, maybe 10 over the last century. But in Louisiana, there's these red twin towers. And what's happening down there is, you know, we're naturally sinking. So So we're far out ahead of sea level rise in regards to the rest of the country. What we're facing today is going to be faced around the country later on. So this is on top of the sea level rise data. This is the these are some of the storm surge heights. And you can see it's going to be quite devastating when we have hurricanes in the future. And I hate to bum y'all out because the next slideshow is going to be about all the things that we can do to leverage nature to turn this stuff around. And it's quite hopeful. So just please bear with me. All right, so why should y'all care? Why should people care in the Pacific Northwest? And so these are some of the reasons. This photograph in the bottom corner of the bottom right-hand corner of the slide is the Loop. It's the Louisiana Offshore Oil Port. 15% of the crude oil that's used in this country comes to that buoy. So it's quite important for national security. But just some of these other statistics. We have 50% of the country's refining capacity. The second largest producer of oil and gas. We're exporting almost 60% of the country's grain supply. So when grain is harvested in the Midwest, it's barged down the river and then loaded into ships. And something like 10% of the world's food supply passes through New Orleans via these and other grain ships. So to give you an idea just how important the Mississippi River Delta is as far as shipping, I'm going to show the trends at some of the other ports. So this is from the port of New York, New Jersey, and these are truck routes here. This is the port of Houston. It's getting a little bigger here. And the port of Long Beach, there's a lot of container traffic coming in from China there. And this is the port of South Louisiana.
Oh, whoa.
These are just the human reasons. The ecological reasons are very important too. There's a lot of seafood that comes from there. These species are all interconnected in different ways, just as they are here. South Louisiana is one of the most ecologically diverse places on the continent. There's all sorts of neotropical birds that stop over there on their way down to South and Central America. The Gulf of Mexico fish they like something like 90% of them depend on these coastal wetlands to breed or live. So our commercial fishery is quite important too. We have these impressive stats to back up the workforce down there that's dependent on that resource. But then there's the intangibles, like the culture in Louisiana. This is a Mardi Gras Indian, mm-hmm. and if I'm sure these guys, they're nowhere else in the world is this going on. And these folks, they make these suits by hand, and it takes them many years. And they have these kind of dance hall battles in the street. It's quite entertaining, and it's really hard to put your finger on it. It's something that when New Orleans is gone or has to relocate, is going to go away. Just living on the water, there's this. Louisiana isn't like Florida. It's not like a vacation spot. It's a working coast, and all these folks that live down there, they depend on that resource. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons why that are just, it's really difficult to put your finger on the cultural aspects, but Louisiana is just an incredibly unique place. So there are ways to solve this problem. The sub-delta, the photo on the slide, bottom right, this is the Wax Lake Delta, and the Wax Lake outlet was created to divert water around Morgan City. And what was happening there, the city was flooding, and they just dug this outlet so it could get out to the Gulf of Mexico quicker. And in about 40 years' time, this delta formed. And we can recreate that in other areas. It's just about getting the political will. Mm-hmm. So there's also things like Bear Island restoration, marsh creation, where sediment is actually pumped from the bottom of the Mississippi River out into wetlands to create habitat and a storm surge buffer. And then there's things like, you know, we just can't solve this problem in its entirety, so we need to start raising people's homes and flood-proofing businesses and things like that. So this is the 2012 master plan, and the diversions, like that new sub-delta, there's two that are in engineering and design right now, and they're going to be built here. With the new sea level rise data, these two diversions down here have actually been pulled. My home is on this dot right here. So the state of Louisiana isn't officially saying they're giving up on certain areas, but they certainly are. There's been some Bear Island restoration along these areas here, and then also some marsh creation in spots like here, right here. And y'all, please jump in if y'all have questions. If y'all want to stop me, I would really love to.
Richie, so is that going to be enough to counter the rising sea levels that are expected?
Not at all. Up until just a few months ago, the state had a position where they were using older sea level rise data, and with the diversions, they were predicting a net land gain. Something like 2062, and they're starting to admit now that won't be possible anymore. So I think the best that we can do is actually have a controlled retreat and start thinking about how to live with water better. But this plan isn't cheap. It's a $50 billion plan that still is, just like I mentioned, just a controlled retreat, and that's going to be paid for in a few different ways. GOMESA is it's this Gulf of Mexico Energy Security Act. It's an act of Congress that pretty much ties offshore oil and gas revenue with restoration, which may be like grabbing the sword that's kind of stabbing you. So, and the state is positioned to get about $180 million of that starting in 2017. 90% of that is dedicated to coastal restoration, 10% for coastal infrastructure, like levees and bridges and those sorts of things. The state chips in $105 million a year, but they depend on oil and gas for their revenue, and they're pretty broke because of the downturn in the oil and gas industry lately. Also, BP is on the hook for $500 million for the next 15 years due to the Deepwater Horizon explosion and subsequent 87-day-long oil spill.
So a lot of the money seems like it depends on oil, the oil and gas industry, but looking towards the future, one of the numbers you gave was 2062 for the net gain of land, and that was an old number, I understand that, but looking that far into the future with the potential switch from petroleum products to potentially renewable energies, do you see a lack of funding coming from the oil and gas industry as a result of that switch towards renewable energies?
I think the folks at those companies are very sharp, and I think they're going to start taking advantage of renewables. Right now, off the coast of Block Island, there's a wind farm under construction, and they're using the barges that are putting it together from Louisiana, the jackets, so the actual platforms themselves, are built down in Houma, Louisiana, and the blades are built down in Lockport, LaRose, Louisiana. And the wind off the coast of Louisiana is favorable 65% of the time, and you know the folks there, they don't mind looking at oil platforms, they're not going to mind looking at wind farms. So they'll just think of it as another artificial reef to go fishing at. Mm-hmm. I just think it's going to take a little political will to make it happen. People need to start positioning, you know, away from oil and gas, thinking about those things. Those companies, they have shareholders to worry about, and I'm sure they're savvy enough to realize that this is the way they need to start going. Okay. Gus?
I thought, I mean, I'm not a hydrologist, but I thought if you start building levees and canals, etc., that I thought that would maybe increase your sediment and actually build land instead of seeing, you know, where you're getting more water. I mean, aren't there parts of the Mississippi that they have to dredge to actually get the barges through?
Yeah, at the very mouth of the river near what's called the Head of Passes, it's the classic Bridgefoot Delta shape. Can we get the lights? So this area down here, it may be hard to see if anybody wants to come up, by all means. The river has to be dredged, and what's happened down here, there's so many distributaries that the water just slows down and the sediment falls out. But it's only down here, and building land down here won't help protect the city of New Orleans up here. So there, nothing less than moving the river delta 40 miles inland needs to happen. And you can imagine, think about the community you live in. If you had to move it 40 miles inland, how the different user groups, or just 40 miles, how the different, you know, people that are there, you know, you live in Wenatchee. So if all those apple groves had to move, if you had to move the dam, if you had to move the river itself, you know, how hard that would be. And it seems like that work has been quietly underway for a while, and it's really just starting to kick off in earnest.
Will it be possible to maintain the ocean-going ships to the Port of New Orleans without raising the levees, and what are the costs and consequences of doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. They'll be able to come in and out of the river, no problem. If we didn't have to worry about the international shipping, the problem would fix itself. It's keeping the river dredged to 50 feet deep. That's the problem. If we could just let this turn into a big sandbar down here, the water would overtop each year, the sand would be deposited, there would be accretion year round. But the folks living down here are, you know, being sacrificed for the economic prosperity of folks in the rest of the country. And there is a article in the National Geographic in 1897 talking about the Eads jetties. There's this gentleman, James Buchanan Eads. He was a salvor from St. Louis, and he devised these wooden dikes that pretty much narrowed the river, and it caused the river to flush itself out and get deeper. And this article went on to say that the shipping is going to increase 100-fold in New Orleans, but we're going to ruin the delta. But don't worry, we'll be able to rebuild it 10 times over with all the economic prosperity that this is going to bring. That being said, some of my acquaintances are river pilots, the guys that get on the ship, these international ships, and guide it up into the river. And their line of thinking is, we're not getting off of our route. We don't care if we have to take a speedboat 50 miles offshore. You know, those folks, they have it hemmed up. They're very politically connected, and they're not allowing the river to change. They don't so much as want some sort of lock structure that would force water out further inland and then have a slack channel below that. They want to be able to get in and out as easily as possible. They're politically untouchable.
So to gain access to New Orleans on a less circuitous route, they built the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet a while back, and then no one used it. Is that right?
Yeah. So to that came about just off the photo here. There was a real big push to develop the eastern side of New Orleans back in the 1940s and 50s. And there was a lot of shipbuilding going on over there and that sort of thing. But there was no deep route to the Gulf, and they had to bring the ships through a lock, and it really restricted what they could do over there. And so the Corps of Engineers built this canal called the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, and it started off being 500 feet wide and 25 feet deep. And today it's about a half mile wide and 45 feet deep, and it's a conduit for storm surge. What happens is a storm is coming in, and the water is forced up the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet. And while it was dammed after Katrina, just a simple rock dam was put across it, and it wasn't filled in. There's some plans to do some restoration out there, but they're not going to fill in the canal itself, and they're in the billions of dollar range. So, like I said, this is how we got here, and this is the sad part. The next one is leveraging nature to turn this around, and how we can live better with water. And you know, but to get to that point, to see all that good stuff, I think we have to see how we got here. So my apologies for the little bit of a negative slideshow here.
Richie, can you go back to the slide with the various deltas over geologic time?
Oh, sure.
And then say a little bit about the rate of change during that versus in this modern era.
So some of these sub-deltas, they took thousands of years to build. But with a little bit of human guidance in placing material in strategic places, we could make land show up much quicker than that.
Okay.
You know, we've engineered our way into this problem, we can engineer our way out of this problem. It's just finding the political and human will to do it. You know, it's quite difficult.
I'm also curious about sort of that natural subsidence that you've mentioned several times and how that relates to all those various. Tell the story a little bit, I guess, of that.
Sure. So in this area down here in the Birdfoot Delta, mm-hmm. annual subsidence is about 35 millimeters per year. There's a fault that runs right through my yard, somewhere around here. Above that, it's only 10 millimeters per year.
Okay.
So these areas up here are able to be saved. This area down here, no matter how much money you throw at it, can be saved with the new sea level rise data. So, you know, building a robust wetland buffer up here is possible, but not so much down here. And while this is without the wetlands, this is with the wetlands, a lot of this water, none of the water you see inside of Barrier Islands is more than 6 or 8 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
So it won't take too much material to fill that in.
Okay.
So shrimp and oysters and so on that depend on marsh, as fast as that's changing, are those industries disappearing quickly?
Yeah, there's been a huge disruption in the seafood industry. And what's happened is, so in this photograph, you can see it looks like almost confetti out there.
Yeah.
And so shrimp depend on what we call the marsh face. And it's just, you know, think about the surface of this pulpit, you know, the walls of it. And then think about, say, like the surface of a sponge, how it has all these nooks and crannies and things like that. So in this photograph, there's all these nooks and crannies and there's a lot of marsh face. When we get to this point here, there's not going to be any more marsh face and there's going to be a collapse of the fishery. We've already started to experience it. So what's happened with the oysters is a little bit different. Oysters depend on this really specific mix of fresh and salt water and nutrients. And now that certain islands have gone away, the estuary is becoming more volatile. Water is coming in and out at just incredible rates where it hasn't happened in the past. And And so areas that were very, very productive and had oyster reefs that were several feet thick, now it's pretty barren. So what's gonna happen, oyster leases, in Louisiana, one can lease water bottom from the state for $2 per acre per year to grow these oysters, just as somebody would lease a farmer's field here. And so they're currently in areas like this here. And when these diversions come online, they're gonna have to move to areas out here and out here. And so some of these folks have been doing this, you know, it's in their family for four or five generations, and they've spent lots and lots of money developing these oyster reefs. They've taken bottoms that were like a tapioca pudding and spread out a net, and then put clamshells over it to distribute the weight, and then collected sea oysters with their boat, and then spread them out very gently to start off these reefs. They've arguably made the estuary more productive by doing things like that. And that's why we haven't had diversions yet. And those folks, and you know, it's really difficult to operate with, you know, different user groups in this setup. But my third presentation is gonna talk more about how do we create a plan that's equitable and democratic, and that's gonna solve these kinds of issues and get everybody to the table.
Has the quality of the water changed at all outside of the oil industry with all this disruption?
I don't believe so, but I think when the rest of the oysters go, that's going to be an issue, because they filter a lot of pollutants out of the water.
Mm-hmm. How about the temperature of the water?
That might be going up due to climate change. We're seeing species that we've never seen before. You know, this is the northern Gulf of Mexico, so species that are trying to get out of these warmer temperature waters are starting to show up in Louisiana. I've been catching a lot of mutton snapper lately, and if I look at them look at the range online, they're down in the Caribbean. They're starting to show up at some of the oil and gas platforms now. Pretty tasty.
So, Richie, could you talk a little bit about your family? When did they first come to Louisiana, and what did they do then, and what do they do now?
Yeah, sure. So, everybody in my grandparents' generation is from somewhere else. My maternal grandfather was from North Louisiana. He came down chasing oil. My grandmother is from Roatan, off the coast of Honduras. They met in New Orleans. And then on my dad's side, my dad was an Air Force brat, and his, you know, my grandfather on my dad's side came from Mobile, Alabama. He was stationed there for a while and really liked the fishing in the state. So, my grandmother on that side was from Alabama too. And so, my mom, my dad, my dad's a fisherman. He catches live bait. He's actually had to change his business model due to the volatility in shrimp prices and shrimp just not being there like they once were. So what he did, instead of catching shrimp and then just tossing them on ice and bringing them to market, he outfitted his boat with these huge tanks and swimming pool pumps and oxygen machines, and he catches the shrimp and he keeps them alive, and he sells them to like 8 or 10 different sport fishing marinas. And so instead of getting 40 cents for shrimp that 100 of them equal 1 pound, now he gets 32 cents per shrimp. So it's much more worth. He went from a two-man operation, now he has to have like 8 or 10 people and two trucks on the road to deliver them and things like that. But a lot of folks aren't changing their business model as fast as they should be. You know, the oyster fishermen, maybe some of them, you know, my stepdad's an oyster fisherman, you know, and I feel like I can say this, that some of them maybe need to look at changing their business model, outfitting their boats with different equipment, trying to take advantage of some of the coastal restoration work coming up. I'm sure y'all noticed the $500 billion BP must spend on restoration. You know, some of that can be done by local vessels and folks.
So who's helping plan how that money is spent? Is there people who actually know what they're doing?
Yeah, so, yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to go down to the master plan slide here. So in Louisiana, after Katrina, before Katrina, there were like 13 different agencies that were responsible for. So there were like 13 different agencies that were responsible for coastal restoration, and after Katrina, there was just a miserable failure of all of those. Nobody could agree on anything. People were afraid to take risks to do this hard work.
Yeah.
And so the state came up, they decided to consolidate all those different agencies and put them into one entity called the CPRA. And it's the Coastal Restoration and Protection Authority. And the only reason why the acronym isn't the other way around is because, it should be Coastal
Protection.
Yeah, exactly. So yes, Coastal Protection. Restoration should come before protection, but they didn't want the acronym to look like that. So that's why they didn't. There's a CPRA board who meets monthly in Baton Rouge, and the public is welcome to go to those meetings and attend. And there's representatives from all around the state. There's, I believe, three west of the Atchafalaya, three east of the Atchafalaya, which is about in the center part of the state, and then different agencies of the government, the Department of Transportation, different government agencies are on that board. That being said, is it really the people that are getting to decide, or these other folks? So this plan is come up by, it's put together by scientists, so it's impartial, at least as much as it can be. It was approved unanimously by the Louisiana State Legislature, which it's unheard of. It's set up in such a way, though, that it's a yes or no vote. They can't change any details in it. But all this planning is based in science, and it's about the best that we have at this point in time. There's some other efforts going on. This design competition that was called the Changing Course, that plans to move the river delta inland, and while right now it's not endorsed by the state, I imagine in the future it will be. The state coastal master plan is updated every 5 years, so it's a living document that changes as new data comes out and new modeling is run, things like that. Gus?
It's a little bit off the subject, but were you there during Katrina, and what can you tell us what happened around your house? Since you're like way down at the...
Yeah, certainly.
And would you expand that to just describe what happened in New Orleans during Katrina?
Yeah, sure. New Orleans. let me try and find some photographs here for you. I'm not getting this on my screen, sorry. It'll be okay. So yeah, New Orleans went through a snow globe. Think about taking the city of Seattle, adding 6 feet of water and shaking it up for 2 days. Something like 1,800 people died. There was over $100 billion worth of damage. Before Katrina, this coastal master plan that we were just looking at was supposed to be $2 billion, since ballooned to 50. And as much as 90 to some estimates. Katrina was a man-made event. We lost so many acres of wetlands. The way the levees were built, they were designed to be behind those wetlands. There were many times where delegates from Louisiana went to Washington and asked for money to raise the levees and improve the wetlands, and they were denied. Corps of Engineers, some of those levees that they built failed. and they shouldn't have. It was shoddy construction. The entire city is different now. It's really hard to put my finger on without showing you these pictures. Who's an IT guy? Anybody's good with IT?
Let's see that on both machines.
Yeah, I can't. I just can't pull it up on this one. I'm just trying to get this folder here.
Right.
It seems like the slide is up. But, but so the town where I live in, it's Empire, Louisiana, and it's you know, this fishing harbor that I was showing y'all earlier before the slideshow, and we had a direct hit from the eye of the hurricane, and I think about driving up to your home. You get that familiarity. You feel like you're home if you've been away for a while. That kind of feeling in your stomach, maybe you're a little tingly like a butterfly, it's good to be home. And you recognize what, your surroundings, the neighbors maybe put up a new mailbox, this tree's getting a little bushier, we've had some rain. When I returned to my home after Katrina, I was a half mile past it before I realized I passed it up. It was utter destruction. The telephone poles were broke off at the waist. We had 19 live oak trees on the property, and now we have four. We had 35 orange trees, they were all killed. There was water sitting on my property for that storm happened August 29th. The levee was finally repaired, the water was pumped out sometime in early November. My parents didn't have running water on the site to even begin hosing their slab off until January. The town subsequently lost 80% of the population between the 2000 and the 2010 census data. It went through the ringer, and people had to deal with stuff like this, reburying their dead and putting their lives back together.
Should get those lights one more time. Can you turn the lights? Thanks.
So, I purposely didn't put a bunch of pictures from Katrina in here, and maybe I did that more for me than for y'all. I just don't want to think about it.
Yeah.
But this is something that nobody should ever have to do. And it's a failure of imagination that we got to that point. And it's just hard to even think about.
I want to go back to the failure of imagination, because that's really an interesting statement. Failure of imagination that they didn't imagine the consequences of what they were doing, or couldn't imagine what would happen if they didn't fix it. Like, could you expand on that a little?
I graduated the year of Katrina from high school, and the second semester of that year, a dozen of us from my senior class were doing this web design class, and luckily my teacher had the foresight not to teach us HTML or anything like that, or even web design theory, but he had us make this website about coastal land loss and coastal change in Louisiana. And one of my, another student wrote this really amazing piece on the worst case hurricane. And it was dated about a week before Katrina came through. And there were many other people before that were sounding alarms and ring bells and just trying to scream as loud as they could. I'm sure some of you probably heard the really colorful James Carville talking about Katrina right after it happened. When Katrina happened, I was in Baton Rouge. I went to Baton Rouge about 2 weeks ahead of the storm to go to school. And you know, I called my mother. I'm like, what are you doing? You know, for the storm, where are y'all going? What's going on? What are your plans? She's like, oh, we're going to the hunting camp in Alabama. You know, it's 200 feet above sea level, 200 miles inland. She's like, yeah, I left all the pictures and the paintings. Yeah, I got the dog in the backseat. Huh? Did you not look at the radar? Like, there's a donut in the Gulf that goes from the Yucatan all the way to Florida, and it's coming right for our house. When you stand on the levee at my house, right behind my house, the land is down here at the level of the floor, and the wetlands are up here. And that's how much we've sank, because we're cut off from that sediment every year. And so even people living along the coastal zone forgot about just what kind of risk they were at. They see these grassy levees on each side of them, and they think it's okay to live on a slab house. And it was a failure of imagination at all levels. You know, just regular citizens, and we shouldn't really depend on the government to take care of us, but that's their role, you know, to maintain and to build those things and to look out for their, you know, to see if they're working correctly. So, and I think there's also something to be said about election cycles. People want, you know, results that can be seen. You know, elected officials want results that can be seen right away, that they're going to get reelected for. If they, you know, hustle up tens of billions of dollars to spend on levies and, you know, and it works 20 years from now, it's not helping them much. And that's some of the ways we got to that point. I did go down and get the pictures and paintings.
Did you?
Oh, yes. Oh my gosh.
Right before the storm.
I was going to say, that was kind of close.
Yes.
Is there kind of any comparison between what's going on there and the Netherlands and the Delta Works? And
Yeah, absolutely. The Netherlands, the Dutch are really great at reclaiming land from the sea, but they don't have these really volatile hurricanes every few years. And so they've done some really impressive engineering, but at the same time, there's a lot of issues they're having with their estuary. There's huge algae blooms there from fertilizer, and they're having these die-offs from low oxygen there and things like that. But between Louisiana and the Dutch, both, there's one common thing between them. The areas that are most below sea level are the most economically productive. And, you know, like, these folks, they don't live below sea level because they're nostalgic. They live below sea level because there's an economic need. You know, somebody has to run the port, somebody has to run the oil and gas, somebody has to catch the seafood. You know, if they had something else to do, they would just go somewhere else.
Look forward to your next lecture.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be much more positive.
What's the population of that whole area that's affected by the coastal restoration and protection plan?
About 2 million folks.
2 million.
Can I ask you one last question?
Sure.
So, the downsides of the agriculture industry coming through there is all the pest or fertilizer and so on. Talk a little bit about how big the dead zone is there around the Delta now compared to 30 years ago.
Yeah, sure. I can't give you an exact number of square miles that the dead zone is, but it extends from around the Mississippi River Delta to just past the Texas border. And what's happening is fertilizer is used inland, places like Iowa.
Yeah. Where I grew up.
Yeah. And so what happens is it runs off, gets into the Mississippi River, and then gets out to the Gulf of Mexico. Once it gets into the Gulf of Mexico, the water stays stratified, so only about 6 inches or a foot at the top of the Gulf is fresh water, and it's just chock-a-block full of this fertilizer, and it causes these algae blooms. And when the algae dies, it sinks to the bottom, and when it's decaying, it pulls out all the oxygen. And so what's happening is there's these, anything that doesn't have a tail and can't swim away, it just dies off. So, you know, invertebrates and things like that are just, there's just these massive die-offs. That's another problem I feel like we've engineered our way into, and we can engineer our way out of. for the coastal planning that we're doing, there's these things called NREDs. They're nutrient retention enhancement devices. It's pretty much a meander. You know, so we're going to, you know, build meanders into these areas where we can scrub these nutrients out with submerged aquatic vegetation. So it's actually going to be a carbon sink too. So that's pretty exciting. Wetlands are incredible carbon sinks.
Richie, how would one go about moving the delta inland 40 miles?
Well,
or is that coming up?
That's coming up, but okay. the short answer is the people that are affected by that need to be the ones making the plan. And that plan needs to be equitable, it needs to be democratic, and it needs to happen soon.
Yeah, so my understanding is that 3 feet of sea level is getting to be really, really conservative, you know, with the understanding of what's going on in Antarctica and Greenland, that sea level rise is going to be considerably more than 3 feet. And if we have warmer oceans, more energy for hurricanes to tap into, isn't the stage set for some really dramatic change? I mean, not to,
yeah,
you know, try to remain optimistic, but it's going to change big time, isn't it?
So a colleague of mine is an architect, and he's helping with this plan, and he's working on some other projects, and one of them is vertical housing. How can we, you know, live in what's pretty much a city that's one building almost, or one, you know, vertical structure? And he's working on this as the East Coast solution to sea level rise. The way he frames it is, you know, unless we start doing something about the climate, how many rings are we willing to put on the bathtub? You know, first it's New Orleans. You know, at what point is it going to be St. Louis?
Mm-hmm. So on this diagram, with a 1 meter sea level rise, everything that's in color there is now underwater.
Yeah.
So everything's underwater, and so New Orleans is saved. Is that because of the current levee system?
It is because of the levee system, and that levee system is made of clay, and it's not designed to be submerged in water continuously. It's only designed to mm-hmm. take 3 or 4 days of water. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't want to make y'all miss dinner.